Welcome to Leaders Under Fire in Sports, brought to you by Culture in Sports. This is where leadership decisions, organizational culture, media pressure, and legal realities collide. Your hosts are legal expert Bob Boland, myself, crisis communication specialist Jeff Chatterton, and with leadership and culture expert Dr. Jeremy Piasecki. Together with our special guests, we break down the moments that put sports leaders under the microscope and what it really takes to respond with integrity, accountability, and impact. This is the Leaders Under Fire in Sports.
Jeremy, yeah. Let's get started. You're too good a story here. Jeremy, you have the most interesting background of anyone I know. You've done amazing things in the world. You are a beacon in many ways, not of hope, but of light and knowledge. And if this program talks about crisis, you're the guy who can undo crisis, who can help create a positive outcome from that. You created Culture in Sports to do this. We'd like to talk to you about this. We'd like to get your view on leaders in crisis, because you've obviously set up an amelioration program. That's your background. But tell us how your vision started. Tell us how you came about getting your PhD, coaching the Afghan water polo team, and ultimately turning negatives into positives.
Yeah. No. Thanks for asking those questions. And it's very interesting to be on as a guest today, as opposed to a frequent visitor. So I appreciate that. The best way to kind of explain my background and why it led to Culture in Sports really comes out of this. When I was an athlete, I saw all sorts of different coaches, right? I saw great coaches. I saw okay coaches. I saw tactically bad coaches, but they were pretty good people. And I just saw horrible, toxic coaches. And I experienced all of them. And then the same thing when I started my coaching career, which was actually when I was very young. And then, you know, throughout time as an adult as well, as a coach, and even back as a professional player, I saw a lot of different types of coaching. And throughout time, you know, just like with families and communities and teachers and just people that you encounter every day, you see the things that you like and you respond well to, and you see the things that you do not like and you don't respond well to, or other people wouldn't respond to well as well. So that's kind of how we came into Culture in Sports, is I wanted to create a discussion of the both positive and negative leadership, ways of leadership and culture, and how it impacts things like organizational success, team and athlete performance, and like the short and long-term mental, physical, and emotional health of athletes. And the last part is important, because that's actually what I focused my doctoral research on, was the lived experience of people who are adversely impacted by toxic leadership in organizations. And it's amazing, not necessarily in a great way, it's actually in a pretty bad way, but it's incredible how people are adversely impacted by toxic and abusive leaders and organizations. I mean, it could be something short term. It could be a few weeks, a few months, or it could last decades. It could last an entire person's, rest of their life, for something that someone chooses to do maliciously. And then once they're called out for it, then it makes the situation worse, and that toxic or abusive leader continues to target who that person is. So put that in a sports setting. You have a coach who, is toxic. And they're bad in that way. I'm not talking about, just an ineffective coach. I'm talking about a toxic coach, one who's malicious, one who's intentional with their actions, and they target an athlete. Do you think that athlete's going to continue to do well? Do you think the team's going to still perform at the highest levels? And those are things to really think about when we're having those discussions about leadership and organizational culture in sports. And that's why we have Culture in Sports.
Jeremy, let me break this up so maybe the audience, if they hear this, can kind of think about it. Because I think we often think about these diagrams maybe incorrectly. We think about everything being binary, good, bad. There's not much in the middle. And you kind of alluded to the fact that there are a small fraction of coaches, maybe you can tell me how big a percentage this universe is, who more or less get it right. Maybe not for everybody, but more or less get it right. Then there's a big percentage, I think, at least based on my knowledge, maybe it doesn't batch up to yours, I'd love to hear this, that get some things right and some things wrong, but are not intention toward being bad. They are the vast majority of the rest of us just sort of struggling to get things done the way we'd like to. Mm-hmm. And there is a percentage of people who are affirmative in and intentional about being bad. Where do we see toxic situations? Are they only in the one quadrant or the one bucket at the end, or can they be anywhere?
So that's the most interesting thing about human interaction, right? So some things where people think that the coaching or the leadership that they're receiving is might even be inspirational, but it's very driven. It's very old school, so to speak. And other people might take that as being toxic and abusive. And sometimes, you know, if you have two people that are in a car accident, you have two different stories. If you have four people that look at a car accident, you have four different stories about what happened. And that's the way it is with human interaction. And so it's very hard and difficult to say if one situation is extremely toxic or one coach is extremely toxic, unless you find out a little bit more about the situation. So if you're talking about percentages, in my doctoral research, I found out that 99% of the people that I surveyed were at one point in their lives or careers adversely impacted by toxic leadership. It doesn't mean that it all happened at one organization. I mean, it happened all around the world. It happened at all sorts of different organizations and industries. So there wasn't one specific group that I targeted. It was a large group. So out of that 99%, you know, were 99% of the people on the same team? No, they were not. And so that's a very difficult percentage to really discuss. But what I can share with you, and I know you've had this experience, Bob, and I know you've had this experience as well, Jeff, is it really depends on the situation and who's being adversely impacted and the why behind it. And ultimately, what I truly believe, and I think a lot of people will definitely agree with this, is if the initial action may be more of a confusion, a miscommunication, once that situation is brought up to that coach or to that leader, and then the leader stops and starts self-reflecting and saying, hey, maybe I should have done something differently, or maybe I'm just not communicating the way I am, and then they adjust with how they interact with those athletes, then you could say that, well, maybe that person wasn't actually toxic. It wasn't intentional. But if the coach then doubles down and is very intentional and malicious about their actions, I think you definitely know what kind of coach or leader that person is.
That matches up what the typical HR circumstance is. People fire themselves a lot of the time. They get feedback. They don't take it, or they don't reflect on it in an appropriate way. And I think you make a great point, is that bad interactions aren't confined to a spot on the spectrum. They can happen anywhere in this process. And they can happen differently in a place where nine people think it's great, one person may easily think it's bad and not be wrong about it. But
exactly. Someone
confronted with that, who's mature and rational, would obviously go, hey, what am I doing wrong here? How can I better explain this? How can I better connect with that athlete? And obviously that's somebody who can disarm some of this. In your experience, how do you disarm, if you're confronted with this, even if it's a misunderstanding, how can a coach move to disarm that and do better?
I mean, ultimately, it comes down to being an empathetic leader, right? So if you have empathy, you can look at things not necessarily through your own lens. You can listen to what that person is telling you. So I've been in the situation before. When I was a young coach, I didn't make all the best decisions, right? So, you know, maybe there was something I said, or maybe there was something I just did where it was an action. I didn't even say anything. I didn't look at anyone, but there was something I did and it wasn't the best example to set. So when I reflect on that And I say, that might not have been the right choice. Do I stay quiet about it or do I share it with the athletes? I need to hold myself accountable. So I need to share it not only with myself, but with the athletes, and I need to make that change. So when an athlete comes to me and they have a perception through their own lens, their own worldview, their own experience, how they were brought up, their morals and values. So they have all these things that they're coming to you with, and they say, hey, I feel whatever the case may be. You know, they feel that they're being treated differently. They feel like they're being isolated. They feel like they're not getting enough playing time because of a specific reason, not because they're just not good enough. Whatever the case may be. As the coach, are you purposely setting that scene and that scenario? Are you communicating that? Or do you think you're communicating something else? And that's where, as the coach, you have to self-reflect. And that is the most important thing, is, you know, on top of empathy is self-reflection. And then if you are a true person, you know, not only to yourself, but to others, you have to hold yourself accountable, not only within yourself, but let others hold you accountable because you're letting them, you're being vulnerable enough to let them do that.
Yeah. Jeff shouted, isn't that really your thesis too? That the leader has to recognize the impact or the crisis a lot of the time and at least speak to it to be successful in turning it around?
It speaks to a level of self-awareness, and frankly, it's a level of self-awareness which is present in the really good leaders that we are all aware of, and very, very much not present in all of the real leaders that we are very aware of because they're not good leaders.
Right.
Shocking. Even the really good leaders in corporate culture, you know, sports, in history, if you look back at their worst moments, it's typically when they've stopped, you know, using a prism, and the ability to reflect, that ability to stop and pause and go, what's really happening here? You know, they dive head on into whether or not they want to expand Major League Baseball or ban Pete Rose from the Hall of Fame or get someone kicked off an NCAA team or something, or should have had someone kicked off an NCAA team.
The angry overreach is one of the ways we see that. It usually causes trouble and it sorts out much longer in the end, and it always comes back the wrong way. Jeremy, you've set up culture and sport and presided over it, doing interesting things, including help bring this podcast to people, leaders under fire, in sports. What do you hope to achieve in culture and sports? What are the goals and audiences you have in bringing us together?
Well, so ultimately the goal is to create a discussion. So when we have shows like this, whether it's Leaders Under Fire in Sports, if it's our Culture and Sports podcast, Hearsay from the Sidelines, which is a joint venture between Seton Hall Law School, which you're a part of, Bob, and Culture and Sports, and our final show, The Athletic Approach. Oh, and whether it's our articles, our monthly culture roundtable seminars, or our annual leadership summit. All these things that we do, and we have curriculum and courses, and many other things, but we're trying to start a discussion, whether it's an internal discussion within the person who's listening or reading or viewing, or if they want to take that discussion and bring it to their peers or their athletes or, you know, the front office staff, and they want to have that discussion of, well, what are we doing as an organization? So we're trying to start that discussion, which creates self-reflection, which creates maybe better communication or just being more aware of what's happening or their surroundings or being a more empathetic coach. One of the biggest things that you know, we've encountered that we've seen change on was a very small project that that Rugby Canada brought us in for, But it was the opportunity to speak to the board when they were going through some immense change. And what we talked about was transparency needed to be the number one thing. And they were actually pushing back at first, you know, and they were saying, well, you know, we don't want to be legally liable for something. We don't want to create a situation where there's a bunch of lawsuits and any donations or money from the government that comes in is now going to be spent paying out lawsuits or just to lawyers. You know, they decided to come out and be 100% transparent. And all we did for culture and sports is we just started the discussion. And then Rugby Canada did the rest. And so, and those are the situations we're in. It's literally to start that internal discussion. And that's all we're trying to do with culture and sports. And so it doesn't matter who the target audience is. It could be professional sports. It could be national governing bodies or national sports organizations. In Jeff's case, because he's Canadian, it could be, you know, NCAA division, you know, 1 through 3. It could be NAIA. It could be, you know, high school sports. It could be club sports. It could be any type of sports. I mean, our, you know, culture roundtable or annual leadership summits, we have everything from professional team owners to, you know, learn to swim coaches that are in attendance. And so we have a wide range of audience, but ultimately our message is the same. Start a discussion, start self-reflection, start thinking about, you know, how things that are happening around you, your actions, your words, what kind of impact did they have? Are they positive? Are they negative? How could you be better? How could you better communicate?
I will say, and maybe it's a bit of a conflict of interest, because I believe all three of us at one point or another have had Rugby Canada as a client. but I've worked with a lot of different major sports organizations, and I will put a very small, very dedicated, low budget team. You know, Rugby Canada hits above their weight class. I will hold their leadership up, as an example to any other sports organization I've ever worked with. They are a phenomenal organization. I cannot.
Well, and that wasn't always the case though. Before, yeah, they used to circle the wagons anytime anything bad happened, and they would force out the person who was the troublemaker, but they were really the ones who were being brave enough to step up and say something about the abuse that they were receiving. But before, back in the day, Rugby Canada used to just push those people away and tell them to be quiet. And those athletes or those coaches didn't feel like they had a voice. Now it's the opposite. And I mean, look at Rugby Canada in the last Olympics. I mean, look at what a huge change that was. You know, Bob, you might want to talk a little bit more about that.
I was simply going to say, we can't give cause and effect. I mean, that's too much to talk about. And God knows, I'm not meant to play women's rugby sevens anywhere or be any help in that process. But the short answer is that Canada was not achieving internationally at the level it was hoping to, and suddenly it turned into a silver medal in Paris. In a way that it came together and was remarkable. So I think that there's probably at least enough of a causal connection to say the steps that Rugby Canada took under the leadership of their board, under the leadership of their CEO is remarkable, and it helped make that outcome on the pitch possible. And I think that's really it, because they were willing to have the courage to dig in and turn it around, which is exactly what culture and sports is trying to do. I know, Jeremy, we can't let you off the hook without having you at least share a minute of reflection on what it was like to put together a water polo and aquatics team in Afghanistan during a period of conflict.
Let's back up even before that. All right, so Jeremy's hanging out. He's a smart, strapping young lad in California.
In California, yes.
Yeah, and
I wouldn't put myself as young or strapping, but I'm in California.
For whatever reason, you end up wearing your uniform.
Right.
Which puts you in.
Okay, so there I was way back in the day, a long, long time ago. No, it was 2008. I mean, I guess that was a really long time ago. So I was in Afghanistan. And I was helping the mission there. and I happened to, there's some Afghans playing soccer with a non-soccer ball, and they enjoyed what they were doing. And so
which service were you with?
I'm a retired Marine.
There you go.
So I'm a Marine officer. So I was watching Afghan soldiers play soccer with a volleyball that was all taped up, and they were having a lot of fun. And I convinced, some people to be like, hey, why don't we have the Afghan soldiers do a little mini tournament? We'll have a couple teams, we'll have 8 teams from all the different units, and they'll play a round robin, and then they'll play, semifinals and finals. So it'll be a fun event. Everyone will have a great time. It'll raise unit morale, so on and so forth. So that happened. And everyone was excited. They were looking forward to doing it next year. So one day, I'm going around this huge area on the base, near the base, and I find a pool filled with trash. And with my aquatics background of swimming and water polo, I, of course, was like, we can do something with this. So I convinced the owner of the pool to clean up the pool, which had all sorts of trash in it. It could possibly, actually it did have some dead rodents in it, but I know that grosses some people out when I say that. So, to clean out the pool, to fill it with water. And I would teach, the locals how to play a game called water hand soccer. Cause there's no actual translation for water polo, in any of the Afghan languages or dialects. So I convinced them to do it. They filled the water, which the pool was only ever used as a reservoir when it was needed. So they filled it with the pool. The water was freezing because it was coming from the mountains. It was not chlorinated. So just keep that in mind with dead animals and just, diseases that we carry as human beings and diseases from bugs, and just keep that in mind. So I start teaching the local Afghans how to swim and eventually play soccer in the water. And they were super excited about what we were doing. The Afghanistan National Olympic Committee heard about what we were doing, and they asked me to come over for a meeting. And they said they wanted to start a national water polo program with the national swim program that they were starting that week. And so when they said help, I was like, I'll help out for a little bit, for a couple months. I'll get it going. It'll maybe be a year. And it ended up being 13 years. And I was in a position where I was leading the national aquatics programs. In the first few years, I was putting in a different kind of effort. I was putting in so much effort, but it was a lot of uphill battles with local businesses that own pools, not wanting to give anything for free or extremely low cost to local Afghans. And it was trying to, just try to get the program off the ground. Then a couple years into it, this person who supported schools, he was a very low minister position. He took an interest in what we're doing in the national aquatics programs, and he really took off and ran with it. And from there, I was really just in a supportive role at that point because, he was really leading the national aquatics programs, which was phenomenal. I mean, we had 10, by 2021, when unfortunately the Taliban took over the country. But until then, we had tens of thousands of athletes in a country. When we started in 2008, we only calculated 13 pools in the entire country that were actually accessible to regular people. So 13 pools, all of a sudden we have tens of thousands of athletes. We have women athletes. And for those who don't know much about Afghanistan, before the Taliban took over, it was already a very strict Muslim country. So, a lot of times women were covered up, maybe except for in the cities. The bigger cities, some women would be a little less covered up, but they still had a shawl around their heads, their bodies were covered. But we had women in bathing suits in a very conservative Muslim country. And that was a win. To top that off, so we had tens of thousands of athletes. We had women athletes. We had a huge disabled athlete population. And for many countries in this world, disabled people in general are just kind of forgotten about. And it happens here in the Western world as well. And so we had you know, hundreds and hundreds of disabled athletes. We had more sheer disabled athletes than all other sports programs combined in Afghanistan. And that includes all the regular programs like you would think would be easy, like basketball or soccer. You know, soccer, you just need a ball and a piece of dirt or grass. And so we had more athletes than all the other programs combined, disabled athletes. We had athletes that went to the Olympics. We had male athletes. We had two women athletes that were supposed to go to the 2020 Olympics. Unfortunately, it was delayed. And then because of that delay and the Taliban taking back over, both women couldn't go to the Olympics because their families were threatened. And unfortunately, some negative things also happened on top of that. But the Afghan national aquatics programs were incredible. We had swimming, we had water polo, we had open water swimming, we had some diving thrown in there. That wasn't really as big yet, but it was incredible solely because the country made heroes for themselves, and it was just incredible watching everything unfold.
I do crisis communications. One of my ongoing long-standing clients is a lifeguard agency. The next time they're complaining about the work conditions that their lifeguards have to operate in, I'm going to introduce them to you.
I think Jeremy should be the keynote at their next meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, Jeremy.
You
said something really interesting, and I want to just plummet one question more. And I know you've hit a great ending for us and tapped it out, but I want to get one encore question in. And you talked about the engagement with athletes with disabilities, and you obviously are somebody who's an expert in making bad situations better. What does it mean when an athlete with a disability is able to engage? What good effects or effects are felt when that happens?
So I've had plenty of conversations with athletes and coaches that we've had about it. But ultimately, they're forgotten about population. Forgotten about isn't even the right phrase to use. They were disregarded. Marginalized isn't even the right word to use. It was like a negative connotation. If someone was disabled, not only were they forgotten about and marginalized, they were forced out of any real positive situations they had for the most part. And so their families were the only really ones to support them. And so now they were coming out, they had something that they belonged to, and they were able to flourish. And it just builds confidence. And it also shows families and the communities that really anything is possible. And so that's the most important thing. And I think that's the way it is in any situation in sports, whether you have, you know, women in a very conservative Muslim country that are playing sports, or you have youth that are playing sports on the street in the middle of war. I mean, you know, if you have something for people to look forward to and goals for people to have and a direction, I think it makes any situation better. And so I don't think it's necessarily a bad situation that was made better. I think it just it shows people what could actually be in the realm of the possible. And that's ultimately where I am in my life. And I've always been that way is, you know, if you look at my resume, I've done all sorts of things. To include, I played professional water polo in Bundesliga in Germany in my early 30s. I mean, I was already way past what people would consider my prime, but I actually thought I was at the best shape of my life at that point. But I was able to do it. And so, yeah, it's, you know, what does Jeremy want to do when they grow up? Oh, you know, Jeremy wants to go get a doctorate, so he gets a doctorate. Jeremy wants to go play professional water polo. Oh, he wants to start, you know, an aquatics program and a national aquatics program in third world war torn country. Like, yes, those are all fun things, but it's really, you know, we as human beings, you know, we're not confined to what people say that we're confined to. I think that there's always something that we could do if we get creative and we find positive ways to do it. Now, I'm saying this from a privileged position as a white male, you know, in a very prosperous country of the United States. And so I'm not in all those other situations, but I do know what I observed in Afghanistan. And I do know what I observed when we would be with the Afghan National Water Polo Team and other countries, and those countries would see how we were coaching and how we were doing things, and they would adjust how they were doing things, even simple things with coaching. Instead of screaming at players, you know, they started taking a more supportive approach, and all of a sudden their programs were flourishing. So, you know, I just think that if people go around and do positive things, I think that's infectious, and other people will go out and do those positive things as well. If we dwell in the negative, I think a lot of people will sit in the negative.
Jeremy Piasecki, Dr. Jeremy Piasecki, founder of Culture and Sports, professional water polo player, international water polo coach, Marine, and a guy making the world better in one situation, in one change of circumstance at a time. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks for being our guest, our friend, the person who helps put this together. We're thrilled to have you be our interview subject today.
Thank you so much, and everyone have a great day.
You've been listening to Leaders Under Fire in Sports by Culture in Sports. These moments under pressure don't just shape headlines, they shape people. They shape organizations and the cultures they leave behind. Thanks for joining me. I'm Jeff Chatterton, joined with Bob Boland and Dr. Jeremy Piasecki, and our special guests as we've examined what leadership looks like when it truly matters. If this conversation challenged the way you think about leadership in sports, we invite you to continue to learn with us at cultureinsports.com. Because influencing positive change starts with how leaders respond when they're under fire.